The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Okay, so we're in B'Shalach, and the theme of B'Shalach, as I see it, is the hard work of now getting Egypt out of the Jews. It's one thing to get the Jews out of Egypt, the physical Egypt, and even to get them out of the dimension of Egypt in a spiritual way, but to get Egypt out of the Jews is a much more difficult process. In God, understanding the Jewish people takes them the long route so that they won't have this quick ability to say, oh, let's run back. They'll see war and say, let's run back. But will counteract their insecurities and appreciate how the longer way is important because they're really not ready to go to Eretz Israel. They're really not ready to get the Torah right away. There's still a lot that has to be worked out. So in a manner of speaking, I would see the desert as a therapy session. It ended up being a 40-year therapy session. It's very expensive. But it was a therapy session. And to a certain extent, the behavior of the Jewish people really parallels the behavior of the growing child. And really we have to understand that the Jewish people getting out of Egypt is like their birth. But the process of birthing is an ongoing process. Even though you have physically left your mother's womb, there are so many things that have to be worked out in terms of really getting out of your mother's womb, really recognizing your identity, your independence, yet the nature of relationship and your dependence. And therefore, if we were to describe the process of a child and a child's struggle towards adulthood, towards identity, towards relationship, towards love, that process we see actually is mirrored in the process of the Jewish people. Now we have to understand, and this is, you know, this isn't so new, there is a philosophy of the history of mankind, which is understanding all of mankind like one child being born. And when you look back in the, you know, the primitive man, even though primitive man might have been 60 years old, but primitive man behaved in a manner which is primitive, which is really on the relative scale of mankind like a child, and every generation is mankind. Like an individual child growing and maturing, and sometimes when you read the stories of the early period, you're kind of shocked. I mean, you know, they seem so unsophisticated, they seem so childish. You know, their behavior. And so too, here the Jewish people have to be understood as a growing child. And their dilemmas, even though they're not children as individuals, but as a nation, and understanding themselves as a nation, they really are children. And the challenge that a child has in terms of coming to grips with what their identity is, and what's the identity of their parent, and what's the nature and the dynamics and the mechanics of their relationship, right, is something that's going to go on and on and on. So the Jew getting out of Egypt has to go through a long process of getting Egypt out of the Jew. And the two aspects of Egypt that the Jew has to get out of, and they are actually opposites. The Jew has to get the Egypt out of them, the Egypt that represents their servitude, their slavery, their oppression, right, their feeling of nothingness. And that takes a while to overcome. And yet there's another thing you have to get out of Egypt, because while you're in Egyptian culture, even though you've been the oppressed one, you've been living in a society which is completely egotistical. And therefore you are also affected by the ego of the Egyptians, the haughtiness of the Egyptians. The Jew on one hand has for so many years incorporated, is absorbed, the slavery of Egypt, and yet there's no doubt that simultaneously while growing up in that society, you've also being affected by the values, and the values of Egypt is haughtiness. And the Jewish people, that feeling, that oscillation, that dilemma between selfless and selfhood, between feeling like you're a slave and yet feeling like you're everything, is a challenge that has ramifications in all areas of their struggle. Because it's also going to determine, or it's going to enhance, the struggle of their oscillation between incredible heights of faith and yet apparent drops into doubt. And we're really quite awed by seeing the Jewish people with such incredible bitachon. Awesome bitachon. There they are in Egypt. They have this, the God of the Egyptians tied to their bedposts, right? They're slaughtering the God of the Egyptians. They're doing all these things which are a demonstration that we believe in God. We define our existence based on God. We know that God is with us. We know that God is going to help us. And the night of Pesach is mamish the highest level, according to Kabbalah, mochin de gadlut, cosmic consciousness, expanded mind. I mean, it's unbelievable. And yet, within a short amount of time, they're frightened, they're scared, they're complaining. So they seem to be oscillating, and we'll see that also in the rest of the story. That they have all these miracles, they get out of Egypt faster than leavened bread, and already they're complaining, and they're wondering, they're dying, they're scared. They have the revelation of God at the splitting of the sea, supernatural visions they walk through, and only after that, right, again they fall and start complaining, where's the water, we're thirsty, we don't have any water. And then they have this miracle of the water turning from bitter to sweet, right? And then they actually find these supernatural springs that is able to feed the entire nation. And then, boom, from that miracle, boom, they start asking, where's the meat, where's the bread? And you kind of wonder, what is going on? You feel like a yo-yo in this whole story. And yet that is the challenge, because they're also oscillating from their incredible realizations, that breakthrough and recognition of God and their relationship with God, and yet they're also tumbling down in terms of, you might have these moments of truth, but then the bringing it down, right, integrating with it, living with it constantly. Okay, so this itself is connected to oscillating between seeing God at those dangerous moments, in those moments which are so crucial that you need the salvation of God, and yet also learning how to see God in every moment. Okay, and all that, all those various aspects that we've just developed, themselves represent a much deeper spiritual dilemma, which goes back to God's transcendence or immanence. Is God transcendent of us and then we're really nothing? Is God immanent and therefore God is moving through us and we're godly? What are the boundaries? What are the limits? Who are we? What are we? Right? To what extent are we godly? Right? To what extent are we? I mean, and all that culminates when the Jews say, is God within us or not? They actually ask that question later on. And all this is connected to what it means to be in the desert and to work it out so they can be ready to receive the Torah, and then they could have gone into Eretz Israel. But the problem is, even after the Torah, they fell. It's a tough one, right? It's tough when children are growing up. They oscillate between illusions of grandeur, where they seem to boss the parents around, and within seconds they just melt into these helpless little innocent kids who are crying because they're afraid that mommy just left them because they went out to throw out the garbage for 5 minutes. Right? And it's that oscillation of trying to get in touch with your ego, and you're trying to get in touch with your sense of self, your self-esteem, and yet your surrender, and all that is happening, obviously. Okay. So to bring all that into the story, we last left the Jews at the sea. And they were crying. And they were scared. And they saw the Egyptians coming, and they lost a little faith. They got a little nervous. And Moshe screams out to God, and God says, go. All you have to do is go. Why are you screaming to me for? The Gemara says that God saw that Moses was being lengthy in his prayer. He said, what are you being so lengthy about? You think it's just dependent on me? It's all dependent on you. And Rashi says, tell them to go. Because the schut of their avot, the merit of their fathers, The merit of their of themselves, the merit of their faith that they've demonstrated is enough. All you have to do is walk towards the sea, it'll open up for them. Right? The natural rules of the world are subordinate to the Jews because the Jews have transcended that and entered into a different world, a world of relationship with God. And the world will serve that relationship. So, you can imagine what a scene, right? Blows you away. They go in. And then the Egyptians come chasing after them. And the sea comes back upon the Egyptians and they drown. They drown. Now, just a few interesting points about that. Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar says that what actually happened was Pharaoh, in the middle of the sea, did tshuva. He did complete tshuva and he was saved. Right? And Pharaoh was saved. And the Midrash says that Pharaoh then went on and became the king. He took a new position. Came the king of Nineveh. And Nineveh is famous because Nineveh is the place where Jonah, who was swallowed up by the whale, was told by God to tell the whole nation to do tshuva, and they listened. Right? That was Pharaoh. Pharaoh was the king of Nineveh. So just interesting note, positive note for Pharaoh. Yay. Okay. It's an oral tradition. Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar is like Midrash. It's not... You didn't get it from Midrash, he is Midrash. Okay. So then, the Jewish people, when they see the Egyptians drown, it says they believed in God and Moses, his servant. And this is crucial. The Yimina Ba'ashem Moshav Do. There had to come to a belief not only of God, but also of Moses, his servant. Because wouldn't it be more impressive if God himself would have gone in there, and mystically, while the Jewish people were building pyramids, they started to levitate, and they just shoot out like jets. Right? They're gone. But why is it Moses? Because God has orchestrated this whole thing that the Jewish people should recognize that a human being can be a servant of God. That a human being can have that kind of divine significance, that human being can wave his staff in service of God and be the vehicle for godliness in the world. Therefore, this is very crucial that at the end of the splitting of the sea, the Jewish people believed in God and Moses, his servant. Okay? And they begin to sing the song of the sea. And we are taught that what the Jewish people saw at the sea, every single person, even a maidservant, had visions of prophecy that goes beyond even the prophecies of Yechezkel ben Buzi HaKohen. Right? He's a Kohen. Unbelievable. They all reach this incredible level of prophecy, the entire people. And if you read the Song of the Sea carefully, what it has in there is not only a song over the victory of Egypt, but they already begin to sing the song of victory of their going into the land of Israel. And they already see the victory on a universal level of the Mashiach coming. And they also see Olam Haba. You read it carefully. These are all expressed here. So like the totality of Jewish history opened up for these people. Right? You can imagine the level they were at. Right? The gewaldic level that they made it to. And so now, that brings us to today's episode. And we turn to chapter 15, verse 22. And Moses directed the Jewish people from Yam Tzuf, Tzuf Ocean, and they went out El Mibar Shur, to the desert of Shur. V'yelchu shloshet yamim, and they walked for 3 days by Midbar, in the desert, below Matsu Mayim, and they did not find water. And they came to Mara, and they were not able to drink the waters because they were bitter. And therefore the place was called Mara, because the word Mar means bitter, just like what? Maror, bitter herbs. any nation complain about Moses, they kvetch. And Moses screams out to God, and God shows him to take a particular piece of wood and put it into the water, and this bitter water turns sweet. And God there gave them some more Torah. The last Torah they got was in Egypt. Right? They were taught about the laws of Paschal Lamb, they were taught the laws of Pesach, the laws of Haggadah, the laws of the firstborn redemption. Right? And now they get more Torah. And they get over here the Noahidic laws. They get certain laws between man and man. They get Shabbos laws. And they get the laws of the red heifer. Various laws. This is all happening in the same scene. And it's there that God tested them. And God says, if you listen, you will listen to the voice of God, your God, and do what is straight in His eyes, and guard His mitzvahs, then the sickness that I brought upon Egypt, I will not bring upon you. I am God, your healer. Okay? Now let's go back to the beginning of this whole story. Right? And how does it fit? And of course, we're a little overwhelmed that people who even their maidservants saw visions of Mashiach, Olam Abba, Mamish, beyond Yechezkel's dreams and his own visions, they're all of a sudden kvetching over water. The Midrash says that the Jewish people did not want to leave the sea. They didn't want to leave Yam Suf because they were so involved. They reveled in that pleasure and the ecstasy of seeing the Shekhinah, having that intimate encounter with God, that incredible knowledge of God's closeness to them, His Yeshua, His salvation, His simple will of love as a father to a child. They didn't want to leave Yam Suf. It was unbelievable. Until the Zohar, until the Shekhinah, so to speak, moved into the desert, and they saw the Shekhinah go off into the desert somewhere, and that helped Moses convince the people, no, this is not the end, you're going to see the Shekhinah more. You're going to have that face-to-face with God more, you'll encounter God more in the desert. It was only after that he convinced them to go on. Now, I mean, they know they're supposed to be going to Israel. They know they're supposed to be getting the Torah. So what is it all about? They wanted to stay at the Yam Suf. They didn't want to leave. And we have a similar midrash like this about the Har Sinai. But they didn't want to leave Har Sinai either. Right? And they have to be forced to leave. And they were told, you're going to see God even in the desert. So let's go. And therefore they went from, it says very clearly, and he directed them from Yam Suf, and they left, meaning that this is very important, they're leaving, and they went to the desert of Shur. Now, what does Shur mean? The word Shin Resh means to envision. Just like our name Israel, Israel also means to see God. Isra, the Shin Resh, means to envision, to see. And so they went to the desert to envision. Because they were confident they would see God over there. And they're going 3 days and they did not find water. Now, what does that teach us? I mean, what does one have to do with the other in the same pasuk?
Water, the other one.
Yeah, but I mean, for it to say, and they left the Yam Suf and they went to the desert of envisioning and they didn't find water. I mean, what does one got to do with the other? I mean, to say that they didn't find water, what does that mean about them? I mean, if it says they didn't find water, that implies that they were looking for water, right?
Yeah.
That means that they went into the desert with an expectation. They left Yam Suf and that high, that closeness, those miracles, and they went with that expectation into the desert. They had no water, and they found no water, meaning like they were very surprised. Hey, there's no water here. Hey, what's going on? Hey, what's going on here? And when they finally find water, what a shock. It's bitter and I can't even drink it. Right? They went with expectations to see God and see miracles and find water when they need it. They didn't find it. When they finally found it, it was bitter. And God set them up, as it says, and it was there that He tested them. This is a test. So they get to the Marah, and they start to complain about Moses. Right? And again, we wonder, what happened to them? But this is their whole challenge. in their relationship with God. You see, one of the rules of a relationship is don't have any expectations. Don't have any expectations. You see, when you have expectations, it's based on thinking it's in your hands. And the way you envision it and what you think should be is what's going to be. And when it doesn't happen, what do? You kvetch. Right? You wouldn't kvetch if you had no expectations, because you knew that a relationship is a fine balance between assertiveness and yet surrender. And understanding that you have to make plans, but on the other hand, those plans are completely in the hands of God, and I don't know what I'm going to see. So they already had preconceived notions of what it means to see the Shekhinah. They had preconceived notions that they'll go into a desert and they'll find water, and they didn't find water. Hey, what's going on? Where's the Shekhinah? Come on, what's going on over here? Where's the old Yam Suf? I mean, what, you told us we'd see the Shekhinah out here. And then they finally get this water, and it's there, they can't even drink it. And so God says to Moses, take this wood and put it in the water, it'll turn into sweetness. And according to the oral tradition, this piece of wood itself was a bitter piece of wood. The wood itself was bitter. And the miracle here is that the bitterness of the wood transformed the bitterness of the water into sweetness. What is all this alluding to? And what does it have to do with Torah? It says, and they cried out to God, and cried out to God, and God sweetened he told them how to sweeten the water, and it's there. At that point, he gave them some Torah. Now you can have some Torah. There is something about this scene which is an introduction to what it means to get the Torah. What it means to live a Torah life. It's there that God gave them Chok and Mishpat. And it's there that he tested them. And he told them, if you listen to my commandments and you do what's right, then the sickness of Egypt I will not bring upon you. I am a healer. What has the sickness of Egypt got to do with this water? What is going on? How is this an introduction to Torah? What does this have to do with the sickness of Egypt? What is this teaching the Jewish people? And how is this helping them understand? Yeah, but the beyond nature was already, that's where they were at. They were already expecting water anywhere, and they were a little put off by, I mean, the beyond nature water is the water that they find right after that in verse 27 when they come to a place called Elima, and there they find 12 springs that are just springing full of water in the middle of the desert that satisfies the needs of an entire nation of only 3 million people approximately. Right? So that's more what they'd expect, and this was just a blow away. And yet it was this that was God's test. And it was here that the Gemara says that they were testing God by complaining. And somehow this is an introduction to Torah. And what does that have to do with healing? What was the first plague in Egypt? The water was blood and they couldn't drink the water. Now how ironic. They just get out of Egypt. They just left all those plagues that those Egyptians got. And all of a sudden, expecting miracles, expecting water to split for you, certainly you get water in its natural form somewhere here in the desert, they get this bitter water that reminds them of the waters of Egypt. And God is teaching them, if you listen to my Torah, then the sickness of Egypt, which is stricking the water like blood and not being able to drink the water, I will not bring on you. So this whole piece is part of getting the Egypt out of the Jews. You got out of Egypt, now all of a sudden you feel like you're being treated like an Egyptian. Well, let me tell you something about what Torah is all about. First of all, in a relationship with God, don't have any expectations. You know, we learn in the Torah that when a person loses their temple, it's like idol worship. Why do people lose their temper? Because they think everything has to go according to the way they envision it. And when it doesn't go, they get upset. But if you had no expectations, you wouldn't get upset because you know that. You make your plans, but it's all in God's hands, and what will be, and that's fine. You wouldn't complain. You say, oh, it's fine, whatever, okay, maybe, you know, we'll pray to God instead of complaining, etc. So in a relationship, for that balance, You have these illusions of grandeur and expectations of miracles daily. Slow down. Those miracles are dependent upon a relationship. Those miracles are dependent upon a daily relationship. It's through the Torah. And interestingly enough, I'm sure that the Jewish people are also a little bit wondering about the meaning of serving God after they just got out of serving Pharaoh. And I think it teaches us basically that just like medicine, it tastes bitter, but it'll make your life sweet. So too when you enter into the daily living of Torah and its responsibilities and its mitzvahs, it might taste a little bitter. And yet it'll be the one that'll transform this, your life into sweetness. And it's here that God tested them. Tested them to understand what are their expectations, who do they think they are, how do they understand their relationship, and that if you don't want to go back to Egypt, it's through the Torah. So God says, I will not bring the sickness of Egypt upon you. You won't get the Egyptian plague if you follow the Torah, because I am a healer. And Rashi brings down, what does it mean, I am a healer? So Rashi says, to teach you that Torah and mitzvahs is for your benefit, for you to benefit from them. Just as a doctor that says to a person, eat these things so you shall not return back to your sickness, so to the Torah. That it takes more to getting out of Egypt than all these miracles. Now we have got to get Egypt out of you. And that's through the Torah and mitzvahs. And even though you think you just got out of Egypt, and now all of a sudden you meet a plague, the first plague of Egypt, to really get out of Egypt, and to really get Egypt out of you, it's a daily process, which is through the Torah and the mitzvahs. And even if the Torah and the mitzvahs seem a little bitter sometimes, because it is a servitude to God, it's actually what it will take to transform that which you thought was bitter into only sweetness. Only total sweetness. So, the Jewish people, getting out of Egypt, now have a long way to deal with what it really means to get out of Egypt. And what it really means to get Egypt out of them. And they are oscillating between these illusions of grandeur, which is expecting to see water, and then when there's no water, they have this chutzpah and this helplessness, and they start screaming. And we talked about it the other day. There are a number of reasons why children test their parents. But one of the reasons that children test their parents is because they need this consistent confirmation that their parent really loves them, because the child is actually very insecure. And therefore, the Jewish people are oscillating between this incredible sense of security and this awesome sense of insecurity as they're coming to some realization of who are they, who is God, what's the nature. And so this is the desert, up and down, up and down. But that's what it takes to do tshuva. But if we were to watch the Jewish people, it's like a pendulum swinging. It swings all the way to the right, all the way to the left, but it eventually gets back to the middle. And that's at the Torah at Sinai, where things get back to the middle, right? And they begin to understand their ongoing relationship with God, but it's not this ongoing relationship unless there's Torah, unless you put some energy into that kind of relationship. Okay, so then after that whole test, and now they understand Torah, and they be given Torah so that they can maintain their relationship with God, and they're able to recognize what it'll take not to ever go back to Egypt, not physically, not spiritually. They walk out of that in Pasuk 27. And they come to a place called Elima. And the word Elim means to be silent. And an Almoni, which is the same word or root, means to be anonymous. They left Mara without expectations now. Right? There's been a fixing in their relationship. They don't have those expectations as they did when they went to the desert of envisioning. They now went to Alema, which means anonymous. They have no expectations. And what do they find? Right? Without even looking for it? Without even expecting it? 12 beautiful springs that gives the nation all the water they need. Okay? And after Elim, they go on. It's the 15th of the month. 30 days have passed after being out of Egypt. And your old tradition tells us that their matzah ran out. And now they no longer had bread. So verse 2, chapter 16. Vayelinu kol eidat b'nei Yisrael. And the entire congregation complained. Al Moshe va'al Aharon. About Moses and Aaron. V'yomru, and they said, Aleihem. B'nei Yisrael. B'nei Yisrael. Mi yitei mutenu b'yad Hashem. Ah, if only we could die by the hands of God in the land of Egypt where we sat on the pot of meat and we ate bread with satiation. Why did you take us out here in the desert so that we should die here and starve? Now, I mean, what's going on? Again, you know, they have this height, this miracle, these miraculous springs, and all of a sudden, boom, no bread. So just ask nicely, say, well, what do you think we should do? Again, they're fetching, they're upset, they're nervous, they're frightened. It's just like a child, right? Just like a child, that no matter how much, no matter how daily their parents take care of them, there's always this fear, tomorrow they'll abandon me. Right? That feeling of abandonment that children have to live with until they're able to come to that kind of confidence that the parents won't abandon them. And so, God says to Moshe, in verse 4, I will cause manna, bread from the sky to fall, and the nation will go out and gather it each day, so that I will test them to see if they will go in my Torah or not. And on the sixth day, they will have a double portion. I mean, what is this all about? Asking for bread, they're fetching again. The manna is just another sequence in therapy. This is going to be bread that will come out of the sky. The Jewish people will have to go out and collect just enough for that day and no more. And what is that teaching the Jewish people? What is that forcing them? What is that forcing them to understand? That you have to have faith in God daily. Even in the little things, you have to have faith in God. You see, some people have faith in God for the big things. You know, when you're pushed against the ocean and you're about to die, that's when you believe God might, in fact, help you. But in the daily needs, people think, my relationship with God doesn't extend that far. It wouldn't, those type of things, even that. As we once learned, Rav Nachman teaches that a person should pray even for a shoelace if they need it. Because you think, there are some things that come from God and others that don't. Everything comes from God. Even a shoelace comes from God. And so the fact that they're being forced daily to just collect what they need is a therapy. Because the tendency of human beings is to collect more than they need because you never know. Maybe tomorrow it won't come down again. Maybe tomorrow it won't be there. If we got it now, let's get as much as we can. Let's put in our safes so we can be secure. And yet this is all part of the therapy of teaching the Jewish people that their security is only in God and in their relationship with God. And trying to hold on to things is not going to cultivate security. It's in fact a demonstration of insecurity. The Gemara says the more property you have, the more money you have, the more worries you have. Because the more you have, the more you have to lose. But when you do not search for security in what people today call securities, which is money, but see security in your ongoing relationship with God, then you've got the most secure thing. I want to share with you a story that once when I was fundraising, I went in, very, very rich fellow, three-piece suit, beautiful office in the most richest, luxurious office building in the city. View, come in there, start telling them, this educational institute, raising money, da, da, da. He says, Rabbi, could I get you a coffee? Well, thank you very much. And he reaches underneath his desk and seems to push something underneath his desk, and a very attractive secretary walks in immediately. She says, yes, sir. Says, two coffees, please. Boom, she's back. Flash of lightning, two coffees, right? Puts it down, she says, cream, sir? Yes. So she pours the cream, right? She says, sugar, sir? Says, yes, but, 351 granules, please. Counts them out, she puts them in. She says, can I stir it for you, sir? Says, yes. And she stirs this coffee for him. She says, Rabbi, cream, no thanks. Sugar, no thanks. Could I stir it for you? That's okay, I can stir it. I can stir it, thanks very much. And I said, Gavalt, I mean, isn't this security? I mean, wow, look at this guy. Top of the world. So I give him my whole pitch, and he looks at me and says, you know, Rabbi, each day, I worry about my security. As, oh really? You never know when you could lose it all. You never know. I mean, you don't know. Could, here today, God, you don't know. You don't know. If you trust in your bank account, you don't know. If you trust in God, then whatever you need, you're going to get tomorrow. And this is therapy. They need this therapy. They need to understand what it means to believe in God. They need to understand that God will never abandon them. To daily have that courage to just take what they need and know that tomorrow God will give me what I need. Right? God will give me what I need. And so all I need is to continue my relationship with God. Now that doesn't mean you give up plans. It doesn't mean you plan ahead. It means you don't believe in plans. You don't put your trust in plans. And that itself is what this pasuk says, because it says, I will cause the bread to come out of the sky, and the Jewish people will go out and collect it each day, day by day. They're going to have to collect that manna. And this is in order to test them whether they go in the ways of Torah or not. Because the way of Torah is balanced. You see, there's two things going on over here. You have to realize and appreciate it's going to come out. It's going to come down from God. But that doesn't mean you're absolved from going out and getting it. I mean, the Jewish people can say, of course, I believe in God. In fact, I'm sure he's got a fast delivery service and I'm just expecting the buzz at the door. Boop! Your pepperoni pizza manna. I mean, you know, if God really loves me, well, why didn't it just fall on their tables? Why just fall on their doorstep? No, they have to go out and collect it. You still have to do something. It's a relationship. It's a balance. It's a balance between hoarding it and thinking you don't have to do anything. It's all in God's hands. So, tomorrow morning, hot manna buns and manna scrambled eggs. And it's the balance between thinking that it's all in my hands, I've got to hoard it, hoard it, hoard it. That's the balance of Torah. I want to see if they'll go in the way of the Torah. Because all this is learning how to know that it's in God's hands and yet that's still in my hands. You know, it's in my hands, yet still it's in God's hands. To realize Hashem Elohim daily, right? To see that bread coming down daily and holding back from the fear of abandonment and the over insecurity of trying to hold on to something, and just receiving it from God. So it's a therapy. It's a therapy between parent and child. It's a therapy to get the Egyptian servitude out of their brain and yet also the Egyptian haughtiness out of their brain. The balance. Right? The extremities coming together into unity. And it's a balance between expecting just the big miracles and having any expectations at all and yet having the ability to see God in the daily requirements that God provides. And when you think of it, when you watch the whole getting out of Egypt, it seems to be that they are just descending. Because they left Egypt on beyond time schedule. Beyond space. They reached this supernatural height. And all of a sudden, at that very height, they seem to be crashing. Height, but not as high as before. Crashing. And yet, if we were to watch the whole graph of the Jewish people from Egypt to Israel, it seems like they've been descending back into the natural world. And here we are again, no manna coming from the sky. Here we are again, working real hard to make the bread. Right? And so you'd say they're descending. The truth is the Jewish people are descending upwards. Because the goal is not only to see God at those special moments at the splitting of the sea, and not only to see God in those unusual, miraculous times of bread coming out of the sky, but to see God even in the bread that you worked for. To be able to hold two pieces of bread, two challahs on Shabbos, and any day of the week, and say, Hamotzi lechem mina aretz. You who took out the bread from the land. Like God took out the bread from the land? I made this bread. I worked hard. And it was human effort that went into growing the wheat and harvesting it and peeling it and separating it and grinding it and kneading it. I mean, bread is so much human work. And yet after all that, you're going to say, Hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz, you God who takes the bread out of the earth, as if it just popped out without your help? That's descending actually upward. The Jewish people are ascending, and the only thing that's descending is the Shekhinah more and more into our daily lives. More and more into the everyday mundane. That's the highest level. The goal of Judaism is to draw the divine into all areas of life. And that's the highest level. And so it seems like the Jewish people are descending and God is removing and ascending. It's the opposite. The Jewish people are ascending and it's God who's descending more and more into the natural process of our lives. And this is what the desert is all about. The desert is this preparation. This desert is therapy. This desert is getting the baggage worked out. So the Jewish people can bring the extremities together from slavery to haughtiness, from supernatural to the natural, from it's all in God's hands, it's all in my hands. All the extremities are being pulled together in the desert with the various tests that they tested God, the various tests that God is testing them in terms in order to create the right balance of the real relationship, the ongoing relationship. And you know, the manna was this very strange kind of food that when they saw it, they didn't know what it was. And that's why it's called manna, because they said, what is this stuff? And later on we learn, when we learn the laws of Birkat HaMazon, God says, I gave you bread that you didn't know what it was, and your fathers didn't know what it was, in order to teach you that not on bread alone does a human being live. What does that mean? Why was it so important that this manna was something that they didn't know what it was? Wouldn't it have been just as amazing a miracle if, as the Jewish people are sitting there, bagels fell out of the sky with Lux, right? Kaiser buns and rye bread. Wouldn't that be just as interesting? Probably even more interesting. Right? Except, and where do we get this stuff that, what is this stuff? You see, if God would have caused the bread to fall on the ground, then we would have thought the bread came from God, but the nourishment was in the bread. But God gave them something that does not look nourishing. In fact, naturally, in terms of what it is, there's no reason for it to nourish us. It's impossible that this would nourish us. And that's to teach us that it's not the bread that nourishes you. It's your relationship with God. You know, someone can give you all the food in the world, but if it doesn't express relationship, it'll just make you sick. It might feed your body, but your soul will starve forever because there's no relationship in that bread. And therefore, the manna itself was an expression of the relationship between the Jews and God, and that kind of relationship that will be daily. Okay, so the upcoming sequences that we have here is just the continuation of this therapy as the Jewish people are descending upwards, or as the Jewish people are ascending and the divine is descending, and we then come to Amalek, which we'll deal with next day.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.